Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I'm usually wearing the hoodie. My wife's got the studio all warmed up in here doing the hot yoga, so I've got the Baltimore Positive hat and the State Fair shirt. We enjoyed some delicious chicken and waffles. I had some shrimp and grits there, socially distanced, wearing the mask, got there early, the whole deal. Please, please, please support local, support our people, support everyone that's supporting everyone out there as we get through this tough, tough winter. It is a Festivus week. Marty Conway, in a previous life, I would be probably taking 200 or 300 people down to Nashville because it's been done before, drinking and boozing and girling and country music and, you know, the whole deal, and probably would be looking toward Buffalo or Pittsburgh or Kansas City next week and maybe a Super Bowl bus. That's what I was doing 52 weeks ago. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, business in the world has changed, hadn't it, Marty?
Well, I was just thinking about that. So this is also coming up on the one-year anniversary of the last time there was actually fans in the stands in Baltimore in any substantial way, right? So sure. Played that first home game. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. And since then, it's been a long, long string of either no fans or a couple of thousand fans for 2 weeks and then closing it back down. And I noted this morning with the postponement, maybe cancellation, not sure, of the Australian Grand Prix in March, because it was a year ago, March 11th and 12th, that not only the NBA shut down, but the Australian Grand Prix, which was the first major global event to cancel.
And so after the Pearl Jam tour, come on, exactly. Now. Give them, yeah.
And that became the point of, are we now entering the second cycle, which would be the most, not only deadly cycle in terms of, you know, deaths and COVID cases, but to the sports and entertainment world, they really can't sustain a second cycle. Some people were just hibernating, hoping to be able to hang on to get through to, you know, this March, April, or May. And if that's not going to happen, then it's going to be a really difficult and dark time in the sports and entertainment industry.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think there's a whole different level here. I mean, I had Chris Pike on earlier this week. You know, Chris and I have been friends forever. You and I are friends. Rick Vaughn is joining me later today.
Oh, great.
And, you know, I love having all of you on because you have a different level of blood on your boots, you know, from having done this all these years. Marty Conway, if you don't know, is a longtime Baltimore Orioles insider in the glory era of Orioles baseball, went to work for the Texas Rangers, Major League Baseball, now sunning himself at Georgetown University as a sports business professor and zooming. You can follow Marty Conway. For those who've never heard Marty on the program, he's a recurring cast of characters, and I'm always 2021, we're into a new year. I'm not even doing sports full-time, but it is a full-time sports week here. And the death of Bob Brown last week kind of caught me, because I literally, Marty, I spent Christmas going through all of my pictures, you know, like I found the first byline I ever had at Sports First when I was 15 years old, writing about Warren Spahn. There's a nice little Warren Marichal picture there for you too, you baseball guys. You know, I found a picture of David Modell carrying the trophy out on Owings Mills Boulevard, big picture people gave me with Brian on it. And I started to think about like the history of all of this and the people that were involved, yep, and the Kevin Burns and the Roy Summerhoffs, the people that you've, the Baker Koppelmans, mm-hmm, the people that you've crossed paths with. And then there's Bob Brown, who, you know, like, I don't want to say I'd forgotten about him. I hadn't run into him. I think the last time I saw him was one of those times they're trying to throw me out of one of the Orioles Hall of Fame luncheons every year. Mm-hmm. Bob loved my cousin. Yeah. So from the minute I met Bob when I was a kid, 1984, 85, working at the paper, Bob was like, to me, if you wanted to know anything about the Orioles, and of course, this is before I knew you, Marty, other than calling Earl Weaver or Hank Bauer or Frank Cashin, or I don't know, I mean, pick any of those kinds of people, he knew more about the Orioles than anybody I ever knew, right? Like, I mean, he truly was the encyclopedia, the history of Oriole baseball in one human being, if it weren't Cal Sr., I would say, right?
Yeah, he carried the title. You know, when I started, he carried the title of PR director. But it within days and weeks, I quickly understood that his role was much, much wider than that. You know, I was hired as a promotions director. We had a marketing.
What year was that, Marty?
1984.
And your pathway was, you came from upstate New York, right?
I came out of the commissioner's office in New York. So my graduate degree in sports management took me to a executive training program in the commissioner's office.
Now, you were in your Oriole logo, but you didn't grow up an Oriole fan, or did you?
No, I grew up in Syracuse, New York. And so we grew up as Yankee fans until The Yankees left their minor leagues team in Syracuse, and the 1977 Toronto Blue Jays expanded with a minor league team a couple of years before their major league entry.
Did you see Dave Steve twirl it in Syracuse?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yeah, oh, my gosh, yeah. The players that came through and as a Yankee, Ron Guidry, as a Toronto Blue Jay, like you mentioned, Dave Steeb, other people like that. So that was we were the AAA affiliate of both the Yankees and then later on the Blue Jays. So, but growing up, you're saying, had to be a Yankee fan because the AAA team was a Yankee affiliate, and we got a Yankee baseball on Sundays with Bill Wright and Phil Rizzuto and all that.
I could go Festivus with you all week. We could talk about the COVID, but I really want to stay in on this. So you get here in Baltimore in 84. So yeah. You walk in and you just put a pelt on the wall. Weaver's out the door, but about to come back in the door. You didn't realize.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about to fall apart when you showed up, literally, right?
Well, that was also at the point where Edward Bennett Williams had spent for free agents, you know, Don Ossie, Lee Lacy, Fred Lynn. You know, that was trying to extend the run to a certain extent. So there was a little bit of magic still left, but it was clearly at the end of that cycle before 87, 88 reared its head. But back to my point is when I came, the organization was a relatively small organization. You know, Hank Peters as the GM and Bob Brown as the general, as the PR, and Pat Santarone running the field. Like those three people were sort of overlords of the entire organization. Everybody either reported to them or looked up to them or took, you know, sort of their marching orders from them. And so, like you said, what I did was, I mean, I was feeling my way, but I was literally watching to see what this man did, because he literally had access to everybody from the manager to the general manager to the coaching staff, you name it. And, you know, it's just a role that doesn't exist anymore, because we've all been put into PR and publicity and marketing and all these other areas. But
not Bob, to mention the website.
Yeah, the website. Exactly. But Bob just carried such a load. And that's why I said the organization lost not only somebody that used to be an employee, but somebody that carried for two decades so many roles, so many hats. And brought a lot of people into the industry, Charles Steinberg and a whole number of, you know, Rick Vaughn, all these other people that worked for Bob early in their careers, took from him. And many of them are still contributing in that same way today.
Well, we're going to honor Bob. I'm going to have Rick on, some other people that knew Bob, but you know, I sort of reached to you for that, and we'll get to the Festivus part of this, but this is, I guess, where we can get to COVID and talk about this, because before you and I even came on the air, the Orioles are hiring, right? They need a new PR director. I guess I'm not qualified, but maybe the new PR guy will give me my press pass back. I have some integrity. But in the front offices of these teams right now, and I said to my wife the other day, Barry Trotz, I invited him on this week because it's been a while since I've caught up with him, and hockey's about to start. And basketball, I see they're dribbling around. My buddy Jack works for the Terps, and I see they're playing some nights, you know, without Morcell, not so well. And the whole cycle of selling this, supporting this, whatever that thing is that's called front office staff, that most fans don't understand the difference between the marketing person, the ticket person, the suite sales, the corporate sales, the box, all of that stuff. But those are real people in all of these jobs. People like you, people like Rick Vaughn, people like Chris Pica was with the New Orleans Saints, and people like Kevin Byrne or Chad Steele, people that people would see on the field. All of those jobs, when baseball and football and basketball and hockey don't put people in the stand, many of those jobs go away. And all of that training and all of the programs you talked about, and I guess you were a real pioneer taking a college class for the business of sport. You know, I didn't know there was such a thing in 1978, but modern days, your kid's involved in the industry, you know. Give me a snapshot of the fear that's going on second year into COVID, where, I mean, what are the Orioles doing? You're wearing an Orioles shirt. You're the only one I've seen promote them lately, Marty. It's the only time I've seen the bird in recent times.
Yeah, so I would, you know, I describe it as hibernation, sort of a forced hibernation. And so what you saw in the first wave was organizations tried to clamp down, keep everybody as much as possible. Some got PP money, whatever those circumstances were. And then you saw months later, little by little. It certainly happened mostly in baseball, where they had to lay off staff, furlough staff. So, you know, in the case of Monumental Sports, where Ted Leonsis owns, you know, the Wizards, the Caps, the Mystics, the building, all those different
things.
Imagine
that, owning the building that you can't put people in.
Yeah, exactly. And so over 600 people employed in his organization between, you know, performance team related and front office folks, they had to lay off a third of those in October. That's 200 and more people, more than 200 people, who families are impacted, friends are impacted, all of that. And that just continued. It continued in Chicago and Milwaukee and St. Louis and California and all these people. So thousands and thousands of people were literally involuntarily thrown out of a career that they had invested, a college education, moving around the country, like I said, family support, anything like that. And so that was kind of the mode. And so, like I say, now that we come up with the beginning of phase two, I think some of the people will decide, and perhaps rightly so, not to come back, because as an industry that has gone through such a shakeout, I know there's a lot of people, the Ravens and other organizations have really worked hard to keep people. But at the end of the day, people look at that and say, what's in my best interest? What's in my family's best interest? Is this an industry that I can rely on, and not only rely on, but build some sort of future, build some sort of retirement, whatever it is. So,
well, on its best day, it wasn't the greatest job, right? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you dedicated a big part of your younger life to it. Yeah. I don't know that if Marty and Nestor went over to run the Orioles, man, and you and I are passion dudes, so I think it would be a little different for us. But if we had to work for a prick in that kind of an environment, that you would want to be showing up at 7 o'clock in the morning and leaving at 2 a.m. every night for 8 months, like most people I knew in the baseball industry kind of sort of had to do. Baseball's a different bird. I mean, hockey, they play twice a week. They go on the road for 10 days. They give you the summer off. You know what I mean? Like, more like a school teacher, you kind of work hard. You have to grade papers late at night, but it's not every night. You get weekends off, and that's different than baseball. Baseball, because Marty, and as my Warren Spahn story, wherever the hell I threw it around here, would show you, all I wanted to be was Ken Rosenthal, right? All I wanted to be was on a plane in Chicago to Milwaukee to Oakland on a 10-day road trip, not realizing, like, once I started doing that, who does the laundry? How do you get a date? Where do you go out? You got a lot of Marriott miles, but that's all you got. And that's from the sports writer side of that. Yeah. But in every one of these places I would ever go as a baseball person, you'd land in Detroit, you'd land in Boston, and you'd realize those people got to work at 9 a.m. and left last night at 1:30 a.m. And that's what they do because they love baseball. You have to love baseball to work in baseball. Otherwise, no one would do it, right? Literally.
Yeah. It's a sport like none other, not only on the field, but off the field. And the way that I present it to young people who are either interested or are working in the game is I say, baseball is like farming. It's not a job, it's a lifestyle, right? Because you have a house and a barn and you live on the acres and your waking hours are spent working in the land and the field. That's the daytime and all that. And then at night, you're still living on the farm, right? You don't go very far away. You have to get up at 5 a.m. Maybe you leave at 1:30, whatever that circumstance is.
You got a sick cow, the phone rings at 1 a.m.
Yeah, I try to describe it as not a job, but a lifestyle when it comes into baseball. And so when you see people who are there for 10, 15, or 20 years, right? Again, game-related, so there's a
Bob Brown. Bob Brown, right? Literally.
There's a small percentage of people that can leave at 6 o'clock that work in accounting or finance or things like that. But the bulk of the organization stays there. And here's the second part. Not only do you work, you know, during the day and during the evening, you work a 7-game homestand or a 10-game homestand. You come back in the office the next morning when the team goes on the road, if you're not part of that, and you work that morning as well. So,
and you're watching the games 4 hours every night because you just are. It's my job. It was my job to do it, right? So like watching the game, showing up the next day and say, I went out last night. I didn't watch the game. I didn't check the score. There's no such thing. Your life depends on it. And then there's the part, like, and I'll bring the Giants into this when we pivot on what happens on a Monday morning when another team tanks and costs you a playoff berth, right? Like, there's all of that built into it too.
Yeah. So in the case of Bob Brown and his PR staff, right, working from 8 or 9 a.m, 8:30, 9:30, whatever it was, through the evening, you know, till the game is over, wrapping up, taking care of all media requests, player requests, all those things. maybe leaving the stadium at midnight, 12:30, 1 o'clock, and then coming back on that cycle at 7, 8, 9 in the morning, and doing that, again, like I said, 8, 9, 10 games in a row. And then in some cases, some of those folks were going on the road as well with the team. So it became that sort of lifestyle. And like you said, what are you left with at the end? Really a lot of great memories, you know, maybe a pension in the case of Major League Baseball or an opportunity. And those people truly dedicate their lives to it. We honor players and we honor other people who have nice careers. We just don't do really enough recognition for folks like Bob and others like him, who, and Rick and other people who put time in one franchise or more than one franchise, and their whole lives are transformed by it.
It is 2021. We are beginning the year off on the right foot. Marty Conway's our guest. He is the good professor at the Georgetown University, longtime Orioles insider. Still wearing a shirt. Is that a leftover 1986 issue? My wife and I were watching Jeopardy because we love Alex Trebek the other night, and the answer was Orin. What is ornithology? And I said, you know, the reason I know about ornithology is because in 89, they changed the bird. You know what I mean? That's when I had to learn that word. So
the ornithologically correct bird. That's what we tried to market at that point. It worked for a little while.
Well, 31 years later, I still remember ornithology enough to get it right on a Jeopardy $800 question. So
there you go. It worked out. Yeah.
I didn't study birds. For the business and the world and the presidency and the former presidency that's staging a coup attempt, all of this as football turns and we get to a Super Bowl and we go through Festivus, I'm not going to Nashville this week. I have great memories in Nashville, as you've pointed out. Eddie George and Ray Lewis, we'll talk about it all week. I might go to Kansas City next week. I'm trying to figure out like my own COVID thing and where I am. One of my buddies in Nashville just popped COVID positive day before yesterday, so it's a mess there. And then they're going to try to stage a Super Bowl and like have a radio row or something from what I understand. I mean, I'm not going to be there. For the league and for what they're trying to do in triple headers and one bye, where are you giving the NFL report card? Last time you and I got together, they were staging games without quarterbacks and making taxi squads play on Wednesday afternoons at Pittsburgh Party.
Yeah, grading them on a curve, if I'm doing my professor hat here, because number one, from the business standpoint, I'm going to give them a B plus or an A minus because they literally powered through a season in order to make sure that every game could be offered and available to its TV partners. Right. So when last time you and I talked, we were talking about shuffling games from Saturday, Thursday to Sunday to Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday, whatever it was, so that those TV partners could be kept whole as much as possible. And I think at the end of the day, I think the lowest TV rating for a weeknight football game, a Tuesday or Wednesday, was around 10 million people. So the NFL achieved its goal on that end, which is to power through, get 17 weeks, 16 games for every team, and to keep their TV partners, and they secured 70% of their total revenues, 65% of their total revenues are secure. So that's number one. So I give them a B plus and A minus on that front because
that allows them to like stay in business. If every business could do 65 or 70% of their revenue right now off the top, we'd all take it. Right.
Not only does it allow them to stay in business, but it proved that they can do this because what's upcoming here is they're going to probably sometime in the next couple of months announce at least one of their new TV deals, which will, by virtue of the collective bargaining agreement, by announcing one deal, it will allow them to go to the NFLPA and convert a preseason game into a regular season game, which will mean that sometime in the next 3 months, we'll learn specifically about what the 17-week season looks like in the NFL next year.
Bring on the Redskins. The Washington, whatever they're going to be called.
Yes, exactly. And so on that
the division champion Washington football team. I need to say that.
On that part, I give them a high grade. On just the sort of public opinion of doing this, I have to give them, you know, not passing marks because, again, the idea that you can just power through this, I just don't think sets the right tone, right? I think there were times, and you and I talked about them, where they just shouldn't have played, right? That just wasn't the right thing to do. Either rosters had been decimated, there were outbreaks in certain cities, there were other things going on that I think they should have said, this is a week that we're going to set aside, and maybe we'll pick this up in week 18 or not play it at all. I think that probably would have been the right message to send. but so often as not, the NFL has a history over the last 60 years between presidential assassinations, 9/11s, others, of just powering through. And so I think I have to give the NFL sort of a mixed grade. From a business standpoint, they did what they had to do to sustain themselves as teams and industries. But that's because, frankly, Nestor, a lot of these organizations have taken on huge debt loads. They've built stadiums. They've gotten themselves here in Baltimore. They actually have the perfect situation. If you're Steve Bisciotti, the setup is perfect. You don't own the stadium. You don't have any maintenance obligations to it. You're out in the county. You come in and play 8 home games, a preseason game or two, and you go back to your sort of home base. Versus other places in Los Angeles and Atlanta and Dallas and other places where owners have taken on substantial amounts of debt in order to run and operate their stadium, not only for football games, but for truck pulls and concerts and other things like that. Those were the debt loads that they were concerned about, which is why they had to continue playing. But a few organizations, and Baltimore is an example of keeping a light footprint. And then I think they can afford to pay everybody and continue to do that because they didn't have that additional overhead like so many of the teams have tried to copy Jerry Jones. And this is what it's led to this year.
I did not watch one snap of college football this year until I put the Notre Dame game on, and they were already down a couple touchdowns when I put it on. And then I sat there. I fell asleep toward the end because it was a blowout. But, I mean, college football, whatever integrity was left, I don't – you know, these college sports, all of them that are there to do nothing but generate revenue, right, at these big schools – basketball, same, you know, playing games. One day they're playing. I mean, all love to my partners at Coppin State. You know, I mean, one day they're on the air, the next day they're off the air. The next day they're on the air, the next day. I'm not NBC. I don't really care. But I would say for what they're trying to do, and you talk about debt load and the Big Ten Network and, you know, all of the money that sits in that dirties up universities. Mm-hmm. Boy, this is a time where I'm holding my nose, Marty. I'm really... I don't know if it's going to bring on global change in the NCAA and how things are going to go down and players not getting compensated. But I'm watching in the middle of a plague, in the middle of an empty stadium, I'm watching football players come and I'm watching a referee just like you, Marty, flip a coin. Yeah. And I'm thinking everybody there is making money except these kids with the helmets on. And I'm like, this is effed up. You know what I mean? I literally thought that at kickoff. I thought there are billions of dollars being generated here tonight for everybody but Trevor Lawrence. And I'm like, it's kind of weird, man.
Yep. No, everybody walks away with something. And again, sustaining television, sustaining ESPN, sustaining regional sports networks. Again, the NBA has announced a 72-game schedule. They're splitting it into two 36-game half of seasons. That 72 number isn't pulled out of the air. The 72 number is so that every team can achieve 100% of their revenues from their regional sports networks, because every contract with every team, as required by the NBA, says that you will be compensated fully if you play at least 72 games. And so that's why they're playing 72 games, not 70, 68, any other number. It's so teams locally can not only get their regional sports network, NBC Sports Washington, or any of the Sinclair, former Fox networks, and then the NBA on TNT and ESPN. That's the purpose. You have teams in California that can't even be in California, right? They have to be in Arizona. So you've got teams from Canada that are playing in Tampa. So there's a whole number of those things and compromises back to my grading system that they've had to make. So on the business side, they get high grades, and on the sort of morality side, I think we give them something less than average.
Well, the NFL is going to deliver a Super Bowl, right? I mean, they're going to get there. We're going to get teams. I would even say for me, and, you know, there was definitely some shark jumping going on when they're playing games without quarterbacks. I won't soon forget that. But I did get over the strike of 82. You know, it's a credible tournament, right? I mean, they're good teams. We're all going to watch. It's, you know, 12-hour blocks on 2 days this weekend. I'm surprised they just didn't go 1-8 and say, Kansas City, Green Bay, you're playing two, you know? Come on, Miami, get on the plane. You know what I mean? Like, that's where, you know, it's the wild, wild west, I think, in the aftermath of COVID for all of these leagues, all these teams. I think college sports, all of it. They've just sort of made this up as they've gone along. It's really, sports is going to change a lot in the next 3-4 years.
Yeah, I got a little glimpse of that. I attended the Peach Bowl over New Year's weekend. Cincinnati was playing in Atlanta. against the University of Georgia. So I went down to visit.
Did you have yourself a chicken sandwich and a milkshake?
Chicken and waffles for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got a little preview of what that is. So in a stadium that held 75,000, the capacity was 15,000. And the other thing that was interesting was that any seat that wasn't sold was zip tied shut. So in other words, you couldn't just walk around and decide where you wanted to sit. So when you looked at it, if the first four seats in a row were sold, then the next 8 or 10 seats were zip tied together. And then maybe at the end,
they literally went through and zip tied 60,000 seats.
Literally. Yeah. When you literally like the little quick handcuffs or things that they use in riding, like that kind of clear plastic zip tie thing. And so what you had was four seats and then you'd have 8 seats unoccupied and then maybe 2 seats on the end occupied. So when you looked around, you saw all these empty seats. And then when you walked around, you realized, okay, you couldn't move around. So those were your seats. That was number one. Number two, when you went out into the concourse, any of the concession stands that were open, all of the televisions around that, which normally have the game going on, none of them had the game going on. They didn't want people to congregate out in the concession areas watching games.
It's almost like they made a whole bunch of no fun rules.
Exactly.
Literally, and said, come, but you can't have too much fun, right?
None of the bar areas were open. There was no seating, no congregation. And so I suspect that that's what the Super Bowl will look like with a reduced capacity, maybe 15 or 20,000. But you'll have, like you said, you'll have such restrictions that going to the game will be such a letdown. You'll have a much better experience watching the Super Bowl this year than anybody going to it because of the restrictions in the stadium. I texted a friend and I said, this was like going to a game in the 60s, right? You might be able to get some refreshments, but you got to come back to your seat to watch. All the things that we've become accustomed to of going to games and socializing and all of that.
You and I love the Memorial Stadium experience. You know, my dad would say, you're not going to watch the game out there. You're going to sit here and watch the game, you know. I guess for the modern experience of doing this, I went up to Philadelphia. I went to Houston. I went to Washington with no fans. And I went to Philly and I sat in the press box there on the 20-yard line. I had a nice seat. And I watched the fans below, and all I could think about, Marty, is that did not look like fun. That did not look like anything I would spend money on. I thought that about the Bengals game the other day. Like, Bengals don't have a lot of fans there when it's open. It looks sort of similar. Like, Upper Deck was a little scattered, and I thought, oh, my God, people paid to be there. Really, like, wow. You know, people paid $180 to be there. And Marty, and I'm going to admit this to Dick Cass because I've admitted it already publicly. My wife and I on the Giants game sat here eating a Pizza John's pizza and some Rofo chicken, watching the game, watching this lousy Giants team that's kind of half trying. Same thing with the Jaguars. And, you know, my seats are $230 those days, right? Mm-hmm. That's a $250 day for me and my wife. And I think about how many $250 day, what a $250 day looks like in modern parlance. And I thought to myself, I'm glad I'm not sitting on the tickets today, you know, and I don't know. I mean, my wife and I have talked about it. I don't know that we want to go to 8 games next year. I don't know that I want to give the Ravens $3,000 in May, even if I have a shot. And I this is really going to change a lot. It's already changed me, I guess, is what I'm saying. I'm saying I'm watching these games on TV and saying, how much am I saving? You know, it's kind of like a car insurance commercial. How much am I saving today? Wow, I saved that much and I still got the game and, you know, I didn't have to deal with it. Well, you know, maybe I won't go back. And boy, that should be their biggest, all of them, across the board. They should be very concerned that a lifer like me isn't saying, oh my God, I can't wait to get back. Saying more like, how much is it going to cost me to go back?
Yeah, so I think what you're going to see, and your emotions and your reaction are onto it, which is a sort of migration. I've said this for a while, a migration away from the preseason commitment. We used to call them season tickets. I don't even really call them season tickets anymore. Some people call them memberships or whatever they are. I just say that preseason commitment that you make, May, April, and that you allow them to carry through. Maybe you pay monthly payments, whatever it is. You and other people like you are going to be less inclined to do that. And you're going to take advantage of the games that you want to go to. What does that mean? That means I don't sit in the same section every time I go, because I'm fine with the fact that I want to go to this game and that game or another game. And I'm going to find myself in a different location around the stadium. And increasingly, Gen Z and millennials are comfortable with that. They are uncomfortable with the upfront commitment, right? Except to something like Amazon Prime or Netflix. Everything else, they'd really not like to make a commitment to, and to pick and choose and have flexibility. And I think that's what organizations are going to face, which is, how do we combine the two where we get people to feel comfortable enough to give us something up front, but then give them the flexibility to decide when and where to deploy that money?
That's what all these platinum passes and like the Orioles have that nerd badge they give you and you come whenever you want. That's the new model, right?
They're trying to do that because what it does, Nestor, it still gives you that connection. I still email, text that person. I have a relationship with that person. But what I don't have is I don't really have that full frontal commitment of four tickets behind the screen, 50-yard line, whatever it is. The PSL business, I think, is going to get thrashed by this around the country, where people are just going to, in Atlanta and other places that were built on PSLs, they're going to say, it's just really not worth it to do that. I'm willing to pay, even if I pay a little bit of premium to a game I want to go to versus a game that I have no interest in, because all this time we're going to see better cameras, better locations. The TV viewing experience is going to continue to get better. And I think people are going to make that decision because, let's be honest, let's close it up here. The NFL has become a weekly reality show. The games themselves aren't necessarily always that good, but the stories around them are so compelling every week that that's what connects us. That's what drives your business 6 days a week, and then the game day, and then you go on another 6 days for the week talking about it, what happened, and what's upcoming.
Yeah, do you want to own the beach house? You just want to rent it once a year, right? Like, literally.
Exactly. So I think that's sort of where we're headed.
Marty, I appreciate you, man. As always, we'll be watching you out on Twitter and LinkedIn as we're watching football and baseball and the business of sports. Always love visiting with you. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, mate. Thank you.
Marty Conway, Georgetown University. I didn't get to ask him about books he's reading and Middle East the soccer tournaments and the World Cup and Baltimore in it for 2026. We'll get to all of that next time around. In the meantime, we are just loading it up here this week. Huge, huge week. Lots of county executives on talking about the COVID situation with Don Mueller. We'll get to that later in the week. But obviously, Festivus and Tennessee, we are going down to Nashville to talk to everyone in and around the team formerly known as the Oilers. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore positive.